Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Well, you know, sometimes I wonder whether committed Christians and atheists actually have something in common when it comes to the book of Genesis. I know you're wondering where I'm going with this, but here's where I'm going. For Christians, often we look at the book of Genesis and say this is the record of the origins of the universe, and so we build lots of scientific theories around it. And there might be something, you know, very appropriate about doing that. But for atheists, they look at the book of Genesis and they say, well, hey, this is the reason why you can't believe in a God, because this is outmoded stuff when it comes to the origins of the world. That could also be argued, and we'll save that for another interview. But I wonder whether the book of Genesis was actually written with an entirely different purpose in mind, and perhaps we've missed it. Marva J. Dawn is an author, a theologian, an educator. She's written so many books. The last time we spoke to her a few years ago was on her book The Sense of the Call, which is all about the Sabbath and living in tune with that. It was fascinating. Her new book is called In the Beginning God. It explores the character of God based on the first three chapters of Genesis. And Marva, it's great to have you with us. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Do you think we've missed the point of Genesis over the last few years?
Well, I think we have. We've been fighting over the wrong things. That Genesis proves that the Bible is old-fashioned and outdated and ought not to be believed. And on the other hand, those who get all uptight that it has to be a six-day creation in 24 hours, and if that's not it, then we can't believe the Bible at all.
So take us to where you think, and what you think was originally on the writer of the book of Genesis, and what was the purpose of the book?
I think that the purpose of the book is to draw our attention to the brilliance of God. It is not serving as a science textbook. It is serving as a praise manual, and it is calling people to worship of God for the immensity of God's design.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now describe what you talk about as the law of worship.
Well, we are longing to turn to someone else besides ourselves. Just like there's a law of gravity, you know, an apple will not fall up, it will fall down. Mm. Human beings have in themselves such a desire to give glory to one who's greater than they.
And what happens when we misdirect that law of worship and misdirect it somewhere else?
When we misdirect it somewhere else, we miss out on our full potential. When we're always trying to prove ourselves as God of our own lives, we get into trouble because we can't accomplish everything ourselves. None of us are brilliant enough to know everything. None of us are smart enough to be able to do everything. And so we finally come to a dead end within ourselves. And instead of being freed to offer all our gifts and to offer them freely, we get in a tight knot of disappointment.
You quote Thomas Merton in the first chapters of the book, who says, I quote, "Your life is shaped by the end you live for. You are made in the image of what you desire." That's really quite interesting, isn't it? Really, we do tend to become what we choose to worship.
I love that line, yes, because when we only worship ourselves, it's quite small.
Yeah, we go nowhere further than what we already are.
That's true.
Absolutely.
That's true.
Now, also, Marva, you talk about we can approach the Bible from a kind of a self-centered position. Just explore that with us.
That's true, that oftentimes when we read the Bible, we ask questions like, what am I going to get out of this? Or how is this going to encourage me? Or what in this is going to uplift me from my present malaise? Or perhaps I'm depressed. How is this going to make me more happy? What trick can I find in here to get past whatever is my mood at the moment? Whereas the design of Scripture is to be read always to think about God. And in fact, that's underscored in Genesis by the predominance of nouns, all in the multiple of seven.
Mm-hmm.
And for Hebrew people, seven was the number of perfection. So anytime anything was grouped in sevens, it pointed to God. Well, every single major noun in Genesis 1:1 to 2, verse 3, is in a multiple of seven.
Mm.
So things occur seven times or 14 times or 21 times. But here's the biggie. The word God occurs 35 times. So much more than any other word. The writer sets up what I call a liturgy. It kind of invites our participation.
Can you give us some examples of those nouns?
one of the things I really love about this liturgy, I was explaining it to a class at a camp once at a lake, and that night was the talent hour, talent with a question mark, when people do funny skits. And this one group did a skit about the liturgy of Genesis, and they had a chorus, and they would repeat these four elements. God said, it was so, or it came to be, it was good. The evening and the morning were the first day. So then it repeats. God said, it came to be, it was good. Evening and the morning was the second day. God said, came to be, and so forth, for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And when you follow that liturgy, it kind of invites you to participate. Pretty soon, the entire audience at that talent show were saying, God said, it came to be, it was good, evening and the morning were.
Yeah. Now take us into, some people won't even, because they don't come from quote-unquote liturgical traditions when it comes to their church background. So explain what a liturgy is, and then explain just what you've talked about there and how that turns into liturgy and where it takes us worship-wise.
Well, liturgy actually means the work of the people. So truly, every church, whether or not they call themselves non-liturgical, has a liturgy, or else it's just performance. If the people don't do anything, if they just sit there like lumps on a log, you might as well go to a movie, because it's just a show. It's just a performance. But liturgy is when we participate. So in every church, people participate in singing, people participate with their minds in praying, and they might have a little refrain like, in your mercy, Lord, or answer our prayer, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. So where do you think then that Genesis pattern, just the one that you've just given as an example there, God said, it was, etc., how does that work into a liturgical form?
Well, the writer of the book intends for us to chime in so that as we're reading, we see, well, God said, let there be light, and it was so, and the light was so good, and the evening and the morning was the first day. So the first day stresses, you know, it's the word yom, and it can stand for era. It doesn't matter how much time it took. The fact was, we've got this great good thing that God desired for us, and that was light. Just imagine if you never had any light. So when we enter into that and say, it was good, you know, this is just so wonderful that we have light. Here in the United States, we're in fall. And there are three trees in our yard that are just absolutely brilliant. In the front yard, we have a maple, which is bright red, just stunning red. And in the backyard, there's a sumac tree that's stunning orange. And then there's a sweet gum tree that is a deeper red, very velvety. But when the sun shines on those three, they are such magnificent colors that you can't help but say, wow, this is so exciting. Look at those beautiful colors.
And that's the excitement there. I mean, that's what really the book of Genesis is talking about, is this God who has actually ordered the world. I mean, and you can actually say, this is a scientific ordering. I mean, you can actually say that, definitely. This is a scientific ordering. Trees don't suddenly become polar bears. You know, that's what the book of Genesis is also talking about, that God has made everything in its own form too.
Yes, and it especially stresses the care and creativity of it, that it just doesn't happen by accident. Whatever processes it takes, it develops according to a design. And what I stress about the liturgy is that we all can't help but say, oh, it's so good. It's just so magnificent. What's stunning colors.
Marva Dawn is with us on Open House, theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast. We're talking about the book of Genesis, the first three chapters in particular, and how in many ways we might have misinterpreted it. Look, we can read it in a variety of ways, but perhaps the main way is that it's a manual of worship. That's what Marva is arguing in her book, In the Beginning God. Marva, you conclude your book with a really interesting statement of belief, this confession of sin and faith at the end, where you actually have these statements that looks like very much they're to be read out loud, and particularly read out loud in a group. I want to just give you a couple of those statements, and I want you to unpack it, because it says something about God, and that's something about our culture and our world when we start to misdirect that worship, as we've been talking about before. You go, we believe that our God is an extraordinary God who continually creates. When our culture destroys, we are worshipping other gods. Take me on.
When I say that when our culture wrecks the creation, like, you know, the United States has been just the worst at gobbling up all this beautiful land that we have and making it full of trash, and we've misused the creation so that the rivers can't run clean and the lakes get polluted, and so much of that the United States has done. But God is working still, giving us possibilities. So now, fortunately, more and more people are becoming attuned to that, and so we are working harder and harder to offset our mistakes. But God offsets them the best. Mm. You know, the purging of the oceans, for example, that God is constantly moving so that the tides bring about better results than what we could accomplish, because we can't control the tides.
Mm, absolutely. Another one that you say here, we believe that this God cares for all creatures and has made enough food for all to eat. When our cultural accumulations cause others not to eat, we are worshipping other gods.
That is especially important to me, because when I was in college, I went on a tour around the world. We went to Korea and Japan and China and Thailand, where we sang for the king, and India. And I was so appalled by the hunger in India and them scooping up dead bodies to throw them into wheelbarrows to take them to the city dump to be burned. So that all my life I have been very concerned about feeding the hungry. And I was delighted when I first learned to read Hebrew and read in the creation account that God emphasized there's enough food for everyone. And so I believe that in this world, God has made the potential for enough food for everyone. And it's our job as the inhabitants of the world to redistribute it so that those who are rich give away to those who are poor, so that everyone can be fed. And I've been working for that all my life.
Another statement you have in this confession is, we believe that this God has an ordering design for sexuality and for one flesh unions to be protected by covenant commitments. When cultural attitudes toward sexuality prevail, we are worshipping other gods.
Yes, there's so much pollution in television and on the web, where all kinds of ideas about relationships develop and are portrayed. And they're usually these days portrayed in television as one-night stands or relationships that just last a little while, and then when you get sick of it, you can start another relationship. But God designed for a man and a woman to be in permanent relationship all their life. And that leads to so much trust and so much confidence and so much freedom. My husband and I got married much older, but we've been married now 20 years, and it is so wonderful. I know Myron's never going to turn to somebody else until maybe after I die, since I've got the handicaps. But I can just trust that, and it gives me such freedom. Everywhere I go, I know my husband's going to be faithful, and he knows I'm going to be faithful.
Another one of the statements in this confession of belief is, we believe that we human beings want to be gods for ourselves. When cultural presumptions make us act like gods, we do not worship the true God, the three in one. Inherent in all of these statements, and there's a whole raft of them apart from what I've just read out there, is this notion that when we act in particular ways — this is what I found most interesting about these statements — when we act in particular ways, we may well have taken our eyes off the one true God and actually settled our eyes on a different God, even if we didn't realize it. What false gods do you think we are bowing to most today in our Western world?
Well, I think sometimes we worship money. We think that the world's going to end if we haven't got enough money to buy all the new super things that are on the market. But God can provide us with what we need, and we don't need to worship money. We can use that money to help other people and use that money to adore God. And living in God's care, we know we'll have sufficient. Another big God these days is technology. Mm-hmm. Oh, if we just get the right technology, that'll fix everything. When technology time and time again proves that it's limited and that it can't be the God of all, because you always got to invent another technology and another technology and another technology. And those technologies are destructive too. But our God is a God who is constantly working positively for the sake of the well-being of God's people. Mm. So those are just a few.
I sometimes wonder whether I worship my watch. I remember a comment by Oz Guinness some time ago in one of his books where he talked about a Filipino group who hadn't had a lot of connection with, say, Western ways, and they were noticing this Westerner with his watch on, and they said, oh, Westerners are those people with gods on their wrists. Because
that's really true.
The little god how tells often, them what to do.
Yeah, and how often we go by time instead of completing a task that is before us and enjoying it instead of saying, well, I got to get this done in an hour. Mm. We can just enjoy the process. Mm. Yes, a watch can be our God. Books can be my God. It's not so much even that I want to read them all as they all interest me because I have endless curiosity.
Yes.
But I just think I've just got to get all these written.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And again, as we circle back to what we said right at the beginning of our conversation, this law of worship means that we want to worship something. We want to bow down to something and say, make me something bigger than I am. And
that's
yet when
right.
we worship our watches or our books or worship technology or worship other people, we will only ever be dehumanized. We'll only ever be smaller, smaller people. God says, no, worship me. That's what the whole book of Genesis is about. Worship me. I will make you fully human and so much more than what you are today.
Yes, I think we miss out on the freedom of being who we are. If I worship the accomplishment of how many books I've gotten written, then I haven't enjoyed the process.
Mm.
And that makes me much less because God created us for enjoyment.
Well, Marva, always fascinating to talk to you, and I do appreciate your time this time around.
Thanks so much. I enjoy talking with you, too.
It's Marva J. Dawn, who is an author, an educator. She's a prolific writer. And her latest book is In the Beginning, God. It's published by IVP, kind of centering on this notion that the first chapters of Genesis are predominantly to tell us something about God.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.